podcast this week. We're live in London and in conversation with James Cameron. Amazing. So spontaneous as well. I love it. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to a very special live edition of the Empire Podcast. Members, exalted members of the Empire VIP Club, prepared to shit yourselves with your mouths wide open. Not my words, Carol, but the words of James Cameron in Empire magazine in 2014, when the great director was talking to us about what we could expect from his forthcoming Avatar sequels. There were just two back then. "You'll shit yourself with your mouth wide open," he said. Naturally, I immediately bought 10 tickets for a movie that didn't then exist. But it does now, because 13 years after Avatar revolutionized cinema, made 3D cool, brought us to a planet we'd never heard of before called Pandora, and became the biggest movie of all time. Twice! Which is a hell of a flex. We're going back to Pandora again with Avatar, The Way of Water, which opens in cinemas next week. And so to celebrate, we have gathered here in the lush surroundings of the Odeon Lux, in the bustling heart of London's West End, to celebrate the incredible career of James Francis Cameron, the man who has directed some of the biggest and best movies of all time. He's a man who directed The Terminator. Oh, this is good. Aliens. Yeah! I mean, he only directed 8 movies. It won't take that long. So, The Abyss. Yeah! Terminator 2, Judgment Day. Yeah! True Lies. Yeah! Titanic. Yeah! Avatar. Yeah! And now Avatar, The Way of Water. Yeah! And a cuddly toy. Very exciting indeed. So Avatar, The Way of Water might just rewrite the rule book yet again, folks. And in just a short while, you're going to be hearing from the man himself in an extensive interview about his career. But first, and this is something that we have actually pre-planned and not just a desperate attempt to fill time because James Cameron is stuck in traffic at the Chiswick Roundabout, the Empire Podcast team is going to natter on about all things JC. And by JC, of course, I mean James Cameron, not Jesus Christ or our Lord and Savior, John Carpenter. So first up, will you please welcome a woman who is a queen, but not an alien queen, thank Christ. She is a geek queen. Please welcome Helen O'Hara! Hello, Helen O'Hara.
Hello, Chris Hewitt. How are you?
I'm good, good, good. Excellent, excellent.
Caught up?
Yeah, good small talk. Next, please welcome a man who arrived here tonight fully nude, muttering something about wash day tomorrow, nothing clean, right? Thankfully, he's found some clothes. Will you please welcome a great big fucking nerd, James Dyer? All right. Okay.
I see you.
I see you, James Dyer. I see you, Helen O'Hara.
I see you, Chris.
I see you.
We can't have everything.
Should we just do this for 45 minutes?
Yes.
I see you. James Francis Cameron. So, we are on the express elevator to hell going down. So, when did we first encounter James Cameron? And I don't mean in a kind of, it's James Cameron in my living room kind of way. When did you first see him? I imagine, because we're all of a certain age, it was Aliens or The Terminator.
And not for me, but you go ahead.
Oh, no, what was it? What was it? Tell me.
Genuinely, I think the first one I saw was True Lies. Because I wasn't allowed. I wasn't allowed to go. My parents were less permissive than you. We know this. And then I had to work my way backwards, basically, from there.
That's not how you watch the film, Helen. That's ridiculous.
Okay. I watched the film in the right. You know what? I'm not going to explain it to you right now. But yeah, I may have seen The Abyss first, but it was either The Abyss or True Lies was my very first one. I did. I stared at it and then I rewind it. I stared at it again because that's how I worked in those days. And I still love it. It's still one of my favorites.
That's amazing. True Lies.
I saw it 3 times in the cinema in the days when I didn't see everything 3 times in the cinema.
Okay, hang on. Jimbo, I know you've got a lot to say about James Francis Cameron, and I feel I'm going to say that every time I say his name now, because I Googled it earlier on and I found that that's his middle name. So you got lots to say on Jim Cameron, and you, Christ knows you've said it, a lot of it already in the past, but Hell's Bells, Terminator 2, did that pass you by?
I was young, and I wasn't.
You weren't
I was
young.
I was. Thank you very much.
How old were you when Terminator 2 came out?
Five.
She was slightly younger than we are.
Yeah, like 11 or 12, I guess.
Because I know it was a 15, and I know I went and saw it in the cinema and had to blag my way in because I was, I think, 14 at the time. But okay, yeah,
14 is more blaggable than 11.
Yeah, it was doable. It was like a stretch.
So I couldn't see that in the cinema, and I wasn't even allowed to get out in the video shop when my parents were looking. So hard. It took a while.
Wow.
See, okay. My mum gave no fucks whatsoever. Like, she literally rented Aliens for me the day it came out on VHS.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to work out how old it would have been, but it probably was about 13, 12, something like that.
Well, it came out in 86.
I can't do math.
You're 63. Yeah. So
it's older than that. Yeah. No, I would have been, because obviously VHS windows were weird.
It would have been 87. Yeah.
The maths is fun, guys, but let's move on.
I like the maths.
So 13, I think it was 13. So actually, probably 12. 12 coming on 13. This is fascinating.
Let's do the math. Yeah. Okay. So Aliens for you, Jimbo.
Yeah. But so the reason why my mother was prepared to rip this out for someone who's vastly underage, because she had worked on Alien, my mom had, in a slightly oblique capacity, and I had been on set of the original Alien in 1979. I remember none of it, but I was on set as a child, and so her thing was, oh, we should watch this film, and then I can fill you in on this incredibly traumatic experience you had that you have clearly repressed since then. And so she hired it out, and so we watched it together. I was 12, and she would tell me to hide when it was the scary bits.
But that's all of it, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a lot of it. Yeah, it was many. You know, the chest burstery scene in the catacombs. That was in the hive.
Okay,
so that was really the bit.
All right. So, what about Terminator? Was Terminator a big thing for you?
Yes, very soon after that. Terminator was what began my love affair with Arnold. Not literally, that came later. But
the one to try in France.
Yeah, like that blew my mind, because I had a friend who was slightly older, and so he would rent out like 18s when I wasn't able to do it, and we rented out Terminator many, many times. Was utterly obsessed with that. The Aliens VHS, literally. So I used to rent. I became obsessed with this film, Aliens, and I rented it so many times that I went in. The guy in the store said these, because you remember, like back in the VHS. Now you're all far too young. Well, you know, so sell through tapes, the ones they sold in like shops were like 10 quid each. They were not the same as the ones you'd buy or rent in Blockbuster, which were designed to be watched many, many times. They were very expensive, about £100 each, and so. He said, literally, it would be cheaper for you to buy this £100 tape than to keep coming back here every fucking week and renting this film. And so he tried to sell me the physical, and I said, no, it's fine. I'm good. I can keep coming back.
Wow.
But yeah, I literally rented it. It must have been, 50, 60 times.
Incredible grasp of economics. Yeah. Can I interest you in a social media platform?
Hey, you don't know how much they charge to rent it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm probably around the same. I was first introduced to James Francis Cameron in I think it might have been the Terminator. Actually, might have been my first exposure to him. I wasn't aware of Piranha 2, which is a film that he doesn't recognize.
Yeah, I don't think he would describe it as a film he directed.
Yeah. Okay. So the Terminator was just amazing, and then Aliens was. I had very, very similar story to you, that we had lots of video stores in my hometown, and my dad drove around town until we found one that rented it I would have been 10 years old at the time. Have an 18 rated really, really violent movie, young boy. Thank you very much. It was Northern Ireland. It was a very, very different place. So that's really where I kind of first became aware of what he was capable of, although I'm guessing I didn't really become aware of him as an entity, as a director, until much, much later.
And you hadn't seen Alien? You went into Aliens cold?
I don't know.
I definitely hadn't seen Alien.
Okay.
Otherwise, I'd be in an institution. But, you know, my mum filled in the gaps.
Okay. All right. So why are we still talking about this man? Some years later.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I said there at the beginning, he has directed in his career just 8 films, including Avatar, The Way of Water. Prolific is not James Cameron's middle name.
No.
It's Francis. I Googled it.
Yes.
But he has had a seismic impact on box office, on cinema, on how they make cinema, and on our poor psyches over the years.
Yeah, no, I think he's, well, first of all, he's always pushed the envelope. When he trained himself up to become a filmmaker, he also trained himself in every job on the set and you know, wanted to understand and know basically everything that was going on. And that still seems to be the case, even though he's working with vastly complicated VFX now. So technologically, he's always been pushing the barriers. Monetarily, he's always been pushing the barriers. He's made the most expensive film ever made at least twice on the record. Mm-hmm. He's obviously then also made the most successful film at the worldwide box office three times, including the one that was twice. so like he's hard to ignore just from a film history point of view, especially given that we pay attention to blockbusters. We consider popular cinema important as well as art house cinema. And so he's a
dig at Sight and Sound. I don't know if you caught that. It was quite subtle. Well,
I mean, not a dig, but like, you know, it's an acknowledgement that it exists, I think, is useful. So I think like he is very, very hard to ignore just from that point of view. He's also really good. Like, I feel like his worst films are very good by any reasonable standard. Piranha. Okay, we'll just leave that aside.
We're ignoring that. We're leaving that to one side.
But you know, I mean, what's his least good film?
Oh, that's a very difficult question to answer.
Right, because they're not bad. None of them are bad at all.
You could cop out and say one of the documentaries, but that's
exactly
not really,
that. Yeah. Let's just leave it at that. But like, I mean, I adore The Abyss, and I know that's the one people go to. But I absolutely love it. It's got so many great moments, that movie, and it's so. The set pieces in that are so fantastic. My robot vacuum is named after one of the little robots from The Abyss. I just love it so much.
Which one?
Little geek, not big geek. It's quite a small vacuum.
You're big geek in this relationship.
I'm big geek, right, and it's little geek. But you know, I think it's brilliant. I also think he does what a lot of your favorite filmmakers don't do, which is acknowledge that women exist and have interior lives.
Wow, that felt unwarranted, but okay, let's go with that.
I don't mean you guys don't, but like I feel like a lot of the filmmakers that you grew up on and admire, and who are part of, quite frankly, James Cameron's generation, do not share his ability to write a decent female role. And he has an incredible ability to write a great female role and has done so consistently throughout his career.
It is actually a sorry state of affairs, isn't it? If you look up on the internet, James Cameron hallmarks, it will say strong and textured female characters. Like, this is so unusual that it deserves special mention. That and Running Feet, weirdly. There's another thing.
Running Feet.
The motif of running feet.
That's a good
runs
point.
Runs through his films.
Yeah.
And of course, nuclear bombs.
Yes.
Nuclear explosions.
And corporate malfeasance.
Corporate malfeasance. Mm. These are great IMDb keywords. Well,
this is the other thing. He's, you know, I mean, as a big old lefty, he's also, he stands up for the underdog consistently throughout his career. He is, you know, very, very wary of capitalism, despite being super good at it. You know, he's like, there's a lot to love about that for me.
Does he have a badge?
Super good at capitalism.
Yeah. Well done, James. You've earned your super good at capitalism badge.
You've got to stop watching Hey Dougie.
Really do. I do not want to stop watching Hey Dougie. It's amazing. I want James Cameron to adapt Hey Dougie after he's finished with the Avatar movies. That would be incredible. But yes, he is super good at capitalism. But you know, he's also super good at developing themes about the environment and environmental themes, and about how basically, and this is fun, we're fucked. And we're all going to die. And that's been something that has been part of his work from the very, very beginning. Right back to, I mean, I'm going to ask him about it in the Q&A, but, you know, a student short he did when he was at college was about the extinction of the planet. Fun. But it clearly was something that he was thinking about. I mean, the Terminator is about that right from the off.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, he kind of came of age in that sort of Cold War era where, you know, global disaster seemed imminent. And I think people who are smart and were paying attention did grow up with this feeling of we need to look out for that.
I mean, now where everything's fine. So
this is the weird thing. Like now maybe we're like the frog in the boiling water, you know, maybe it's been going on as background noise for so long that nobody seems to be as alarmed as we should be, but it's like 90 degrees in here, you know, possibly literally next summer. I think it's weird that some people saw the reality of the threat and some people just kind of don't still now. And I think he's, you know, I think he's absolutely right. I mean, he got a lot of kind of flack for that, especially with Avatar, where it was like, oh, it's a, you know, very thinly disguised environmental parable. And it's like, yes, it is. Yes. That's that's good. And maybe we should do, I don't know, more of this. And I don't want to get back on my hobby horse of why do we keep making the greens the baddies in movies? But why do we keep making the greens the baddies in movies? Why do we keep having the bad guy motivated by attempting...
As I've said many times, Helen, Thanos is very misunderstood, radical environmentalist. I think we can all agree.
But this is my point. It shouldn't be Thanos trying to save the environment. It should be Cap, you know, and it just, ugh. Anyway, so I, at least, you know, James Cameron is getting the sides right, I think, in a way that not everybody is.
All right. Okay. So should we talk about Avatar? Because we got Avatar, The Way of Water coming out. And this movie comes out in 2009. I looked up on the internet. It did pretty well at the box office. Yeah.
I'm responsible for all of that, by the way.
Or really? In what way?
Because I did all the coverage. I was on set. Did I mention that? I was on set of Avatar. But I wrote Empire's coverage for it, and that's why it made all the money. That's science.
That's it.
You can't argue with science, Chris. That's
okay,
that's what happened.
That's it. Yeah. What did you do on set? What did you see?
I saw... you know the when he does his Patton speech, his welcome to Pandora.
You saw Quaritch.
I saw Quaritch. Yes, indeed. I saw the thing that he does in front. You know, it looks like it's a big like a ventilator that looks like the American flag. So it's a deliberate Patton reference. And wandered all around the pods. I spent the day on set. John Lennon.
Were you just like eating jujubes the whole time?
I was eating jujubes. People's eyes actually. It was curious. But yeah, that was fun. Just little things like, so I got to play with the RDA guns. They had the little machine guns, and it's a really random thing. You never even see it in the film, but the magazines are full of like rectangular bullets. They're not spherical, they're rectangular, like the casings, not the actual bullets. Because he was just like, well, obviously it's more, you pack more into a magazine that way. So it just made more sense. The level of detail that they're actually thinking about the shape of the, which you're never going to see on screen. And yet that's what they were. I may or may not have stolen one.
Really?
Yeah, I do have it at home.
James has just admitted to a crime.
I can say that because Disney didn't own it at the time, so it's fine.
Okay. Statute of limitations.
Yeah,
it's fine.
It's lifted.
You can commit a crime in 2007, I'm guessing you're on set, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. In New Zealand.
That's 15 years ago, and that's totally fine.
It was.
There's an accord in the land.
As your lawyer, just please both of you stop talking.
If anyone committed a murder in 2007, you were totally fine.
No.
The Empire podcast absolves you.
No.
You are all
once
good.
Again.
It's true.
If you want to commit a murder tonight,
no.
You'll be fine in 2037. Okay? Just stick it out until then, and all is good. Yeah. But Avatar is, you know, how many times has this guy been written off? And you know, Titanic, he gets written off. Titanic,
well, he had a razor blade taped to the side of his monitor, and he had a little thing on it saying use in case film sucks, like literally. But genuinely, like, because I did a big career interview with him, god, must have been what, 5 or so years ago, and he was saying that at that point he was 100% certain that was the end of his career. Like that was it. He was 100%, this is it. This is the last film I'm ever going to make, because it's cost so much money. It's gone so over budget. There have been so many stories in the press about the PCP and the fucking chowder and whatnot. And the fact that, you know, when the boat's ass is up in the air, they couldn't get the lights up high enough because none of the lights, it was too high. They were like, and they hadn't thought it through. Little things like that. And so there were all these stories, and it was costing so much money. And the studio was like, mate, you have fucked this. And he was just like, yeah, I might have fucked this. And then, you know, they did a test screening and it went off the charts, and then the studio execs saw it and they were like, I mean, it's still going to die on its ass, but at least you made a good film, so we're not going to look like idiots when it dies on its ass. And then it didn't die on its ass, and people saw it again and again and again, and then there were all this money, and then they were making him coats out of money, and then he made a house out of money, and it was just ridiculous. And there it was. And you know, it's an interesting one, because he says he learned a lot from The Abyss of how to make that film. And he said that the regret he has about The Abyss is that he couldn't tie the philosophical aspects and the emotional aspects together. He felt they were two distinct threads, that they don't really marry up. So I kind of disagree a little bit, because I think it works really well. But I think he wanted it to be more seamless. So he took it as the greatest compliment that Titanic, which is an effects-driven movie, is not seen as an effects-driven movie, it's seen as a love story. And he was like, well, that means I've succeeded, because that's what I was trying to do. All of these effects, all of this money, but it's a boy meets girl story. It's Romeo and Juliet on a boat. And I think that's why it works. And it's the same reason, that's why it made all the money. That's why everyone loved it. It's why, you know, everyone now pretends they don't love it when they secretly love it. And he always said, like, when he redid it in 3D, it was so that men could cry and no one would notice because they were wearing glasses. And I was just like, I cry the shit out of that film every time I see it. I have no shame. But I think that's his talent. Every single film he's ever made is a love story. All of them. Every single one. And I think that's one of the reasons why they work so well, because they're about emotions and they're about characters. And all of the shit that goes on around it, whether it be alien worlds, sinking ships, androids, aliens, all of that, it's all just background. It's all background to the to the emotional stuff.
There aren't many lines in cinema more romantic than "I came across time for you." I mean, that's pretty good. That'll work, right?
I feel like that would work. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've also said, you know, what I think is the hottest line in cinema history.
Which is?
Is Hicks saying...
Draw me like one of your French girls.
No, it's Hicks saying, I think we should take off nuke the site from orbit. It's the only way to be sure.
Oh, yeah.
And he's saying it because he's echoing, obviously, Ripley, who's already said it. And he is just taking her on her word. He is just trusting that she knows what she's talking about. He is treating her like a competent human being, while also himself being a competent human being. Oh my God, it's so hot.
But the way he looks though, when he says, it's the only way to be sure, with fuck me eyes.
Oh. Yeah.
It's just amazing.
Is that where he goes? It's not like we're engaged or anything. I mean, but it is. You're totally engaged now.
Yeah, that is.
I guess, you know, looking at Aliens back in 86, that was the first time I unconsciously was shipping someone. Oh my God, I was shipping Ripley and
Hicks.
Then
you found out his name was Dwayne.
His Dwayne, yeah. But he made Dwayne cool before Dwayne Johnson.
Yeah.
That's how cool Dwayne Hicks is. And yet you're just watching Aliens going, I hope these crazy kids make it out okay.
I hope they don't crash.
I sure hope they don't crash land on another planet and then get killed off screen. That would be terrible. That would
worst
be awful.
Worst decision ever.
Yeah. But it's the power of Aliens. And I realize we started off talking about Avatar, but fuck it. We'll get back to Avatar and we'll talk about the other movies we haven't mentioned real quick as well. But it's the power of Aliens that... It still, for me, gets the heart racing every time I watch it. The end, you know, Bishop's countdown, the bit where they fly away from LV-426 as it explodes behind him. Another nuclear explosion in a Jim Cameron movie. Tick your box. And it's just pulsating every single time, even after Alien 3. Fine movie, but come on. It could have ruined Aliens, and it doesn't, and that's testament to the power of it.
It's the greatest film ever made. I will die on this fucking hill.
Aliens, 23 Key to Commerce, 1080 Brazils, I think you'll find is the greatest movie ever made.
I mean, I'd watch that.
I would absolutely watch that. See, Alien Queen stuffing a chicken.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I prefer it to Alien as myself. Because
it's better.
Alien is a very elegant, beautiful, haunted house in space movie. You know, it's stripped back. It's brilliantly constructed. Aliens, though, is like fun. Like, it's still scary. I am a wuss. I am still scared, but I'm also having fun. I'm enjoying these characters. I'm rooting for these people. I care about them. I'm really invested in them in a way that I'm not really an alien, even with all the, you know, great dinner scenes.
There's an emotional heart to it, which there isn't in Alien. Alien has no heart whatsoever. It has the scares and it's brilliantly constructed. It's like a perfect sort of horror movie in that regard. But Aliens has that, you know, and even more so in the special edition where it kind of really hammers the fact that she's lost her daughter in that kind of, where she's essentially, she's died of old age while she's been away 57 years. And then Newt becomes this adopted daughter and it's sort of the bond between them. And that runs all the way through it. It's beautifully
done. Funny. It's funny.
It's also funny. She's funny. Fucking Bill, the late, great Bill Paxton. One of the greatest roles in cinema is Private Hudson. Love him.
Yeah.
Love
amazing.
Him.
Amazing bad guy as well. Paul Reiser as Burke.
And at the time, like, it's fucking Paul Reiser from Mad About You. Do you know what I mean? Like,
he wasn't technically Mad About You at that point.
But he was a stand-up comedian. Yeah. You know, like, it's like he was so cast against type, but he's brilliant as Burke. Yeah. Evil company man. And you can tell because he has a suit and he wears the top part of the collar up and the bottom part of the collar down, and that's fucking weird.
It's futuristic, James.
I have a future shirt collar. Look
he
at
is,
me.
He is a futurist. He is a futurist. Yeah. And so is James Cameron. Good segue, Chris. Well done, everybody.
That was very good. Well done.
But he is. Helen mentioned earlier on that he pushes the envelope. Figuratively.
Okay.
Figuratively, he pushes
an envelope. An envelope full of money across the table to the effects guys and says, do something you've never done before.
Yeah.
And that's impossible, ideally. Yeah. And then they do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they've done it several times. I mean, the amount of breakthroughs, the amount of things that James Cameron has personally invented and designed.
It's insane.
It's wild. Sam Worthington is entirely CG. Did you know a lot of that? He does, right from maybe not so much the Terminator and Aliens. I mean, that's something we can talk to him about. But certainly on The Abyss, he begins to push
the pseudopod.
CG can do with the pseudopod. Yeah, and then from that into T2, which just, I think, blew everyone's minds. And still, 31 years later, continues to hold up.
Yeah, it looks
magnificent. The effects on that are astonishing.
Mm.
I think that's because he demands the time and the money from the studios that he works with to get CG right. When you see, again, I'm banging the old drum. When you see bad CG, it's not enough time and not enough money. Generally, it's not enough talent usually. Yeah. So it is usually that the studio has not, you know, has had a release date or something locked in place and they have not been able to finish. He does not allow that kind of thing, I think, to happen. And so, yeah, he pushes, you know, effects and, but gets the teams that can deliver that, you know, quick enough, and he gets the money to pay those teams, which is really important. So yeah, I mean, all those breakthroughs that you said, and then going on to Titanic and the sort of the subtle effects of, you know, not just the ship sinking, which is quite a big job of effects, but also, you know, those digital doubles, also the mist from the mouths, all the little touches that make it seem real. That's where he, I think, excels over most people.
And that's kind of where he starts an awful lot as well. Like he's talked about this, and he may talk about it with us, but he's talked about in the past that Avatar began as a responsibility for him as the CEO of Digital Domain to find something to push the envelope for Digital Domain to do and to work on successfully. So he went away and he developed this idea he had for donkey's years about this planet, this bioluminescent planet, and then goes, all right, guys, I guess we've got to do this now. We've got to build this completely new system of performance capture. We've got to build this completely new camera system. And he did all of that just to kind of push the effects further, but never loses sight of the human story either, or the Na'vi story.
It's about storytelling, isn't it? It's like the whole 3D thing, right? Like when Avatar came out, obviously we all knew, we'd all seen Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare. We'd experienced the glory of 3D on the big screen. But like when he did it with Avatar, it's one of the reasons people went back again and again. Like you weren't just watching, you were on Pandora. You were experiencing this firsthand. And then everyone else did their stuff in 3D and fucked it. And it got to the point where any time anyone handed you a pair of the 3D glasses, you were just like, oh, just die.
You would die, yeah. A little part of you would die
a
inside.
A little part of you died. Yeah. People just ruined it because they didn't understand. They were doing it for the fact that they could charge more for the tickets. They weren't doing it because the storytelling demanded it, and they weren't doing it because Cameron at one point wanted to release Avatar exclusively in 3D with no option for 2D. He did relent, but like he felt that strongly about it because it took away that barrier and it sucked you into the film. And then when this comes out, and you'll see this in the trailer as well, it's like it's 3D, but he also plays around with high frame rate. And obviously we've seen that before when Fellowship of the Ring first came out. Was it? No, Far Hobbit, wasn't it? It was the first Hobbit film came out. That was in high frame rate and it was an abomination. And then was it Genesis Man? Wasn't it Genesis Man?
Gemini Man.
That's it. Yes.
Gemini Man.
I knew it had a
professional
title
here, ladies
that's
and gentlemen.
The one.
Yeah.
I know it was a film, but that was again looked horrific because I don't know quite what went wrong with that, but it looked alien. Whereas when you see the trailer for this, you will see, you know, he uses high frame rate when it aids the scene, like in action. And then when it's a dialogue scene, it'll drop down to 24 frames, like, because it's not needed. Yeah. There's no point having high frame rate if two people are having a conversation. And that takes away that alien feeling that you sometimes get, not aliens feeling, that's something very different. when it doesn't feel like the grammar of cinema, because we're used to that judder, that 24 frames judder when a camera
pans. The judder man.
We're used to that, and not having it makes it, you almost react viscerally to it. It feels weird. But actually, from what I've seen of this, that's not going to be the case. So then we'll probably now have another sort of 5 years. Everyone's going to be chucking frame rates at everything. 3D will be back. And Jim, I'm sure we'll apologize for that later.
Yeah. Although I believe he's coming around to everyone's house to fix the motion smoothing on their TV. Him and Chris McQuarrie.
I was about to say, McQuarrie's already done that.
Cruise is going to descend from the ceiling. And Cameron's going to be wearing those big mech suits. It's it's kind of amazing. But yeah, people have been writing them off for a long, long time. Mm. And I think there's been an element of that as well with this, because it's been so long since the last Avatar, or the first Avatar, they're both the same, that some people are going, oh, has it missed its window?
But also, there seems to be this thing where it's cool to say that Avatar wasn't a good film. Like, on what planet, don't say Pandora, was Avatar not a good film? Like, it's a fucking brilliant film. And they said that about people, like, oh, Titanic. It's like, no, it's an amazing film. There's a reason why it made all the money in the world. Like, it's not just luck. He's an incredibly intuitive filmmaker, and he understands what makes a great film. He's never made a bad film, so.
I mean, look at all the kind of, there weren't that many knockoffs of Titanic, per se. There was one called Passengers, which was, I think,
Titanic
described
amongst
by someone as Titanic Amongst the Stars. But in the wake of Titanic, there weren't that many knockoffs of Titanic, but a lot of films that try to recreate the feeling of Titanic, and they missed by several leagues.
I think the thing about Cameron, I think, is that he has a lot of confidence in himself. He may have had a long dark night of the soul or two on Titanic because it was a horrendously difficult thing to do. But he does know what he knows about storytelling and about character and about the basic appeal of movies. And I think he delivers that every time. And he kind of knows he's delivered that every time. So he knows what he's doing. And it makes all the difference. You know, all the toys in the world, and we saw that with the 3D boom. You know, you gave 3D to most people and they just like had the old arrow coming off the screen at you. You gave it to those Scorsese and Spielberg. They knew what they were doing with it and they used it beautifully, actually. You gave it to Cameron and he knocked it out of the park. So it's not just about having the toys and having the ability to use them. It's about tying those then in, as James was saying, to the story and to the emotion of the piece. Mm. And that's also why, you know, frankly, he's made, I think to be back on my horse, but like a lot of the reason that people don't like Titanic and Avatar is that they are nakedly emotional and that they are loved by women. And I think genuinely a lot of people dismiss things that women like
it's not even that.
It's like, I think the way a lot of men are brought up and conditioned, they are instinctively told to reject girly things. And that's a condition of manhood for a way that a lot of men are raised. And like you get grief from, like, my dad used to read his sister's like Chalet School books and then literally people would laugh at him. Do you know what I mean? It's just like you get taught to reject female-coded things as a man, and that is what makes you masculine. And I think that's nonsense. But because Titanic and because Avatar are more openly female-coded, even though other ones have female leads, I think that's why people are quicker to dismiss them, or one of the many reasons.
100%. And with Avatar, like Titanic, obviously on a very clear level, but with Avatar, well, the love story is, it's a boy meets girl love story. And it is, as you say, nakedly emotional, but it's also a love story between someone on a planet. Do you know what I mean? He's falling in profoundly in love with Pandora, as Adrian Marr once said. And you can tell there are no older people in this room. But genuinely, like, he's falling in love with the planet, the place, the people. He's falling in love with the Na'vi. And that's what it is. He's forming a bond with a people. He's going native.
And, you know, going back to Aliens.
always
go back to Aliens. Look what he did with Ripley as well, who in the first Alien, you know, is obviously played brilliantly by Sigourney Weaver, but there's nothing really about her as a woman, nothing really about her as a, you know, and we could discover that she's a mother, and he leans into that aspect of her in Aliens.
Yeah, I think he made her into his own kind of heroine. But what's interesting is if you compare her to the Terminator, because, you know, Sarah Connor at the beginning of the Terminator, she's literally in like a fuzzy peach cardigan. Like she could not look less like an action hero. And to have her go from that to what we see in T2 is an incredible, and that's within his own film. So it's not like he's been handed this girly girl and then done that with her. Like he's given her an arc within his own story. And I think Ripley, again, he bases it in everything we've seen before and then just like takes her along on a new thing. Cause she, like, even in that, she's not like starting out trying to, you know, use the mech suit to throw punches or something. She's just using it to do her job, you know? So she's just kind of doing what she does, being a normal person in the world when she gets back from the adventure of Alien. And then Chekhov's power loader. When the situation calls for it, she has to fire the power loader from the mantelpiece. Chekhov gets a bit confusing. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to say, get away from her, you bitch, in the third act. That's what happens.
Greatest moment in all of cinema.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay. That brings me very neatly on to your favorite James Cameron moments.
All of Aliens.
I mean, obviously.
There must be a shot in Aliens you don't like.
Oh, there isn't. Oh, well, actually, no, that's not true. So I remember one of the interviews I did with Cameron, I asked him, like, what do you go for? Do you go for the director's cut, which you think you probably would do, or the theatrical of Aliens? Because I have real issues with this. So I love the longer one because it's 17 minutes more of Aliens. Yeah. But my issues with it, like, I don't like the reel where Newt's parents see the ship, because I think it takes some of the tension out of what you're going to find on LV-426. And I don't like the scene with the hamster, because it directly repeats the scene that you get afterwards with Newt. But if you take away those, you've also got to take away the sentry guns, and they're
don't
amazing.
Don't take away the sentry guns. Don't do it.
So I struggle with which one to recommend to people.
Okay, so favorite moment from Aliens you think is "Get away from her, you bitch."
I mean, that's... No, do you know what? If I had to pick a moment from that, it would actually be the 5 meters, man, four, what the hell?
That is incredible. When
it can't be, that's inside the room. It's reading right, man, look. I'm going to do the whole film now. But just that moment, just the absolute naked terror of that, when he just looks up and he goes, fuck, and he just lifts up the ceiling thing and then full. Yeah, anyway.
That film is so quotable.
It's incredible. And the motion trackers are just... genius.
In the early days of Twitter, pre-Elon, we once at Empire did a kind of Aliens quote along. Do you remember this? And we shed thousands of followers within about 4 hours because we were just quoting Aliens incessantly.
Affirmative. They mostly come at night. Mostly. Newt, my name's Newt. Nobody calls me Rebecca except
this is just
brother.
A Carrie Hen quite along at this point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a hen night. What can I say? Anyway, come on. It's good stuff. You didn't pay for this. Hell's Bells, favorite Jim Cameron moment?
I really like the pseudopod in the abyss. He seems friendly. I also love the resuscitation scene in the abyss.
Such good.
I love the horse in the elevator in True Lies.
The horse in the elevator.
Yep. Love it. Yep. I like the man who hits the propeller in Titanic. I'm not proud of it, but I do. I like when you notice how many times they say, Jack, Rose. It's just a lethal drinking game. I'm told I don't drink, but don't do it. If you drink every time they say each other's names, you will die.
Yeah. If you do heroin every time.
And I love the first flight scene in Avatar. I think that's magical. Absolutely magic.
Did you leave any movies out there?
I did. Yeah. Some of them. Yeah.
Terminator?
It's the romantic bit. Yeah. You've already said it. Terminator 2. It's maybe The Floor.
Oh, that's a nice shot. I like
that. Great shot.
Yeah,
where he comes with the T-1000 comes up behind.
The thing with Terminator 2 is it has that amazing Cyberdyne sequence. And in any other film, that's your third act done. Like, it's finished. And it's the beginning of the climax of that film. That's like the sort of the foreplay for the actual action sequence. You've got the freeware, then you've got Steelworks. There's so much more to come. It's just amazing.
So Terminator 2, which we haven't really talked about that much.
It's amazing. Second greatest sequel ever made after Aliens.
After Aliens. Just narrowly pipping Naked Gun 33 and a third. No, it's an amazing, amazing film. And he's done it twice. He's done two of the greatest sequels of all time. Mm. Jimbo will obviously say the two greatest sequels of all time.
Yes.
I mean, I am telling The Empire Strikes Back on you, but okay.
That's fine.
Well, I'm telling Evil Dead 2 on both of you.
I will die on this hill.
What can I say? But yeah, it's such an incredible film. But this is his third sequel. Mm. So... what do we think? Can he do it again?
Fingers crossed. I mean, I think there were a few months ago they showed a little bit of footage and it was extremely exciting. So I'm hyped. Can't wait for next week.
Mm. I mean, look, like I say, he has made the two greatest sequels of all time and this is another sequel. So I would say that it bodes very, very well.
Excellent. Well, listen, my favorite James Cameron moment is all of them.
Lick.
Teacher's pet. I brought an apple for James Cameron. All right. Well, listen, I believe the man himself is in the building. So we're going to get the In Conversation with James Cameron part of the In Conversation with James Cameron evening underway. All that remains for me to say, thank you and fuck off, James Dyer and Helen O'Hara. Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the main event? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Will you please welcome the director of The Terminator, Aliens, The Abyss, Terminator 2, Judgment Day, True Lies, Titanic, Avatar, now Avatar, The Way of Water, the legendary James Cameron!
Thank you, Chris.
Hello, sir. Welcome.
Good to see you.
Welcome. Oh, Jim.
So you guys are all sugared up on junk food. That's great. Good.
They all have weirdly a bar of chocolate each. Is this true? Green and blacks. You ever had green and blacks?
Everyone eat your chocolate now. We'll get our sugar rush in about 20 minutes. And then this will get lively.
Oh, yeah. It's going to get real lively. I mean, we were just chatting about your films. We were talking about you behind your back earlier on when you weren't here. And James Dyer there, who was on set of Avatar for a couple of days, he was saying to me that, and everyone else, that you had at one point, you had on set a razor blade with "Use if film sucks."
Yeah, it was actually on the screen of my Avid in the cutting room, and it was actually on Titanic. And, you know, we just all thought we were doomed. Our careers were over. Hollywood had the long knives out, waiting for this big stinko pile that was coming, you know, that they'd all heard about. And it was like wildly over budget and could not but suck, you know. That was the only choice. And so I literally had a razor blade there. It said, "Use in case film sucks," so that every day I would realize what the stakes were.
Yeah.
That's actually a true story.
That's amazing.
And then finally somebody actually saw the movie. I was like, wait.
And realized what they had.
Yeah.
Did you have anything like that on Avatar? Because the stakes were equally out there.
Yeah, the difference was toward the end on Avatar, we kind of knew what we had because we were starting to see it all coming together in 3D. But weirdly, some of the executives at 20th Century Fox didn't believe in the movie even when they saw it finished. It's like they couldn't get seeing everybody in their black tights with their marker dots out of their heads. They just couldn't not see that earliest screening. And they just thought it sucked. And I'm talking about the finished movie that you all know. And they wouldn't even put a billboard up in front of the studio. They had Alvin and the Chipmunks 2, the Squeakquel, instead of Avatar out, you know, in front of 20th Century Fox when you drove down Pico Boulevard. It was like so nuts.
Well, as we all know, Alvin and the Chipmunks 2, the Squeakquel, became the biggest film of all time.
I'll never forget it.
I want to take you back to the beginning, not the very beginning, because I think even you might not remember the very beginning, but I want to take you back to really the beginning of Avatar. So you're 19, but your mind is older.
That's really the beginning.
Yeah. It pops into your head in a dream almost, doesn't it?
Right. So look, I mean, everybody dreams differently. Some people don't remember their dreams, but I've got like a full tilt streaming service that's running all night long, right? And sometimes I get up and write down little bits of stories and stuff. And I remember one in particular. So I'm 19, I'm in college, and I have this dream with bioluminescent trees and purple moss on the ground. You step on it and it kind of glows, and there's a glowing river. The trees kind of look like fiber optic lamps, which is a look that we preserved into the actual film. And I remembered it so vividly that I actually got up and I used to draw in oil pastels for color, right?
Okay, yeah.
So I drew a sketch of the trees and the moss and the little spinning lizards, the little orange spinning lizards. It was all there, you know, but it was just an image or a setting, if you will, right? And then so years later, I was thinking of a cool planet, you know, as part of a story I was writing with a friend of mine, a screenplay for a film we never made called Xenogenesis. And so we had the bioluminescent world. And then years later after that, I was the CEO of Digital Domain, which was the first all-digital visual effects company. And I wanted to do something that would kind of, you know, elevate us in the development of CG characters and creatures and all that sort of thing. So I dusted off some of my old ideas and I wrote this thing called Avatar. And they all told me I was bonkers, that it couldn't be done. And they were right at that time. But I figured it was only a matter of time before the CG kind of, you know, the tide of CG rose and the capability across the whole industry improved enough. And then that so cut from 95 when that was written to 05. Mm. And, you know, I was developing Alita Battle Angel. Mm. And I wasn't liking the scripts. And we set down the path to write one last script, one last try, script 5. And I thought, man, this is, you know, maybe we don't crack the code on this. So I pulled Avatar out from the back of the drawer and I read it. And I went, it's not a bad story. Maybe we should develop that too. And I was thinking sort of the performance capture stuff, could use it for Battle Angel, could use it for Avatar. So we just started developing performance capture, the technique for how to capture the faces. And so we did that, went along for a few months. And then we planned a huge test where we were just going to bring all of our tech together and try to figure out how to do facial capture, body capture, everything. And I didn't have a scene. I looked through Battle Angel. In the meantime, I got a pretty good script in for Battle Angel. I was like, okay, we can make that or we can make Avatar. And it was kind of a coin toss. But I was looking for a scene that had all CG characters. And if you ever saw Battle Angel Alita, it's mostly her in a scene with live action people or one of the other big cyborgs in a scene with live action people. There weren't, mm-hmm. there weren't any dialogue scenes that were CG to CG character. But there was one in Avatar when Jake first meets Neytiri. So I just quickly wrote up that scene in a couple of days and that was our test. And then we never looked back. We just kept going forward on Avatar. And at a certain point, we noticed we were actually just making Avatar. but it really was kind of a coin toss. And then, Robert Rodriguez wound up taking over for me to make Battle Angel Alita while I was, doing this film.
And well, one of the things about Avatar and its success was the way that people felt transported to Pandora.
Right.
We've talked about this in the past a little bit, about how people felt that they actually wanted to go to Pandora and,
saw the film, the new film. Did you mm-hmm. feel that sense of transport?
I did indeed. Spoiler alert, everybody. But yes. Absolutely. I mean, the water is just, I can't talk about it too much, but yeah, the scenes from the water is just beautiful. It's transportational. You just want to go there. And that is something that...
And then a lot of really bad stuff happens.
And then a lot of bad stuff happens to I'm not going to say. Anyway, but in terms of how Avatar was transportational for you, at what point, you said there was a point where you realized we're just making Avatar. Was there a point when you realized, okay, I want to make Avatar 2, 3, 4, 5 and on?
Yeah, it wasn't the kind of no-brainer you might expect, right? So you make this high-grossing film and then, okay, let's make another one, right? But the way I looked at it was, lightning just struck. This might be the only time this ever happens. And do I really want to tempt the cinema gods and say, okay, do it again, right? I also had other things to do, frankly. I really liked deep ocean exploration. After Titanic, I took 8 years off to do expeditions and had the time of my life. And then I kind of crawled back to filmmaking, make a little more money so I could do some more expeditions, basically. So Avatar worked out. So then I, took a couple of years and we built a sub and went to the deepest places in the world, some of the deep trenches. And that was all, really keen. And then, I thought, do I really want to do another Avatar film? It's a gigantic risk. It's really expensive. Maybe it doesn't work as well the next time. I didn't even know there was a pandemic coming, So I thought about it and then I thought, all right, look, we can do a lot of good with this film. It's good to, attract attention to the plight of indigenous people around the world whose native lands are being encroached upon and their cultures destroyed and all that. And since I wanted to set it in the ocean, I can deal with one of my most important subjects, which is sustainability and conservation of the oceans and all that. So we can do some good here. And plus I just really liked my team. I had this great team. I had this great family of actors. And not just the actors you guys know from the movie, but the troop players, the ones that are the kind of unsung heroes that are playing all the other people in the movie. So if you see a crowd of 100 people, it's not 100 people. It's like 10 people 10 times. So, there are a couple of our troop players on The Way of Water that I think have played 22 characters. Wow.
And
because they just really know performance capture, they know how it's done. They're just, they're just solid, experienced people. So we had this kind of Avatar family and that attracted me as well. It's like, okay, well, let's not make just one more film. Let's make three more films. And then anything we develop, any money that we spend to improve the technology makes sense because we can amortize it over multiple films, right? So there were some, you know, it was kind of a business strategy as well, but you have to succeed with the first one. I don't consider Avatar the start of a franchise. If we're successful with The Way of Water, that'll be the start of the franchise because then it's set up to have a proper cadence between releases. You know, much has been made of, oh, we don't even remember the names of the characters. It had no cultural impact, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, sure. Compared to, you know, Iron Man 2 comes out 2 years after Iron Man 1, and then there's the Avengers, and then boom, boom, boom. I'm not dissing them. I'm just saying that it is different. Yeah. You know, and by the way, different directors on a lot of those films too. So if I'm going to have that kind of cadence to stay in the conversation, stay in the zeitgeist, I've got to get it all teed up ahead of time. I got to get all my front end work, all the scripts done, all the design stuff done, so that all we're really doing is post-production, 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 because we're about 2 years just in post. That doesn't include writing, design, actually shooting it, actually working with the actors and all that stuff. So it was sort of like a very big startup torque to get it launched again, which we will or we won't, you know, based on market forces and are there still enough theaters after the pandemic and all that stuff. But if we get it launched, then three, then four, then five, it's all teed up. You see what I mean? So it made a lot of sense right up until the pandemic came along. And then it was like,
It's interesting because I don't think people remember the names of the lead characters in Alvin and the Chipmunks 2, the Squeakquel, either. Probably maybe Alvin and anybody. Yeah,
well, I've got that to cling to now, that, don't I?
But going back to when you first had this idea, so it wasn't necessarily that you had this image. You had this image when you were 19, and your entire career was in service of making that image.
No. I mean, I remembered it years later. I actually dug the sketch out. And it saved us. We got sued by 11 people that apparently thought I had somehow, you know, used telepathy or something. And these are people that wear tinfoil on their heads, you know what I mean? Who thought that I had somehow stolen the idea from them. And, you know, I whipped out this drawing that was, you know, dated in, you know, 1972 or whatever it was. And, oh, by the way, there was another one of a guy in a giant rainforest wearing a space suit that I drew in the 11th grade. And it was literally signed, you know, Jim Cameron 11C, you know, dated. And I said, you know, I've been kind of thinking about this stuff for a while, and I didn't frankly need your dumbass idea in order to make this movie. And, you know, 11 out of 11 lawsuits went away very promptly when they saw all the drawings.
Amazing. So just to go back to your career and how you began, really, because you get your, I'm fascinated by your origin story, so to speak, which I know you've talked about, but the idea that you're driving a truck. Where were you driving the truck, Jim? I've always wanted to know.
Okay, so it's I'm living in Orange County in, you know, near Los Angeles, and working for a school district, and I'm driving a truck that brings the hot lunches to all the schools. So the little kiddies, you know, kind of SpaghettiOs, you know. And the way I drove, I mean, about half of it stayed on the tray, basically. And I feel bad for those little kids now. They were probably all undernourished during the year, a couple of years that I was delivering their lunches.
This is a scurvy outbreak, and it's all your fault.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And so at this point, you're teaching yourself how to make films.
Yeah, so, I mean, that was my day gig. And then you know, I was trying to learn as much as I could about visual effects and production design and all that sort of thing. And what I'd do is on Saturdays, I'd drive into the city to USC, and they have a library there that they kind of call the stacks, right? Where they keep, you know, not only the books, but all the papers written by all their, you know, graduate students and so on. And I just went in and I studied optical printing and, you know, photogrammetry and the, you know, various film stocks and emulsions and really the science of making movies. And I'd find this stuff and anything that interested me, I'd just photocopy it. And I'd put it into these big binders, and I learned all the different techniques for visual effects, you know, rear projection, front projection, camera movements, BIPAC, you know, sodium process, all the different ways of doing traveling matte photography and blah, 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 everything. I just gave myself, you know, a college level class in visual effects for the cost of the Xeroxing, basically. And seems kind of obvious. Like, why wouldn't you do that? You know? And at the same time, I was screwing around with my friends writing scripts and learning kind of script formatting and all that sort of thing. So I was, you know, I was training myself for when the opportunity arose. And when it did arise, you know, I always say, you know, fortune favors the prepared mind. I just leaped into it. And I actually had some skills. They were hypothetical, but I didn't tell them that, you know.
So tell me about that opportunity.
Well, it was Roger Corman had decided, well, they made a lot of money with Star Wars. I want to jump in on that, right? Mm-hmm. So he decided he was going to spend all of $1 million on his own version of Star Wars, which was called Battle Beyond the Stars.
Love that film.
And I got hired on that in the miniature department. But then I quickly kind of ran amok and, you know, and wound up replacing the production designer on live action. Because this guy, he had like 21 sets to build and he had like one built and they were going to start shooting in 3 weeks. So he brain locked or something, you know, so they threw me in. I guess I was the one guy dumb enough to put his hand up. And so then I think I got, you know, probably 2 hours sleep for about a month. It was bad. It was bad. And I didn't do drugs. So it was like a lot of coffee. It came in on my first day as this is to tell you a lot about the time period, right? So this was 1981. I came on my first day on the production designer gig and they said, okay, here's your petty cash voucher and here's your crew list for your day shift and your night swing carpenter group and everything. Here's your Coke. Here's your Black Beauties. And you just, I'm like, what? Yeah, you just give it to the crew. And it's like all of a sudden I'm like a dealer, you know, and it's like people are coming to me for, I'm like, what? This is part of the gig. Like,
wow.
That was what it was like back then.
Different time.
One hopes.
Yeah, that's wild. So all the time, but you're still writing scripts, pursuing directing.
Yeah.
So how do you get to knock that?
Okay, so I go through that whole Corman process. We make a couple of films. We did that and we did Galaxy of Terror. And, you know, I sort of learned all the low budget tricks and, you know, was actually on sets, you know, and on Galaxy of Terror, the director was screwing up so badly that Roger started looking around for a second unit director to sort of like get some stuff done on the sets before they ran out of time and money. And so I put my hand up and said, I can do that. And he says, well, what about production designing? And I took a big chance. I said, my art director can take over for me. I've got everything designed. Now, Roger could have said, well, then I don't need you anymore. Mm. But he didn't. He said, I need a second unit director. So hand it off to the art director and start tomorrow. And he gave me like 10 pages of the script with the actors. I'm like, this is not second unit. This is alt first unit, right? I got to work with actors. What? You know, but then, you know, it turned out that because of, you know, I have a writer's mentality, I kind of got into the characters and I just realized that you just tell actors what the character's thinking. Pretty damn easy once you get into it. But I was terrified, of course, but apparently I did okay. And then, recruited to do this film called Piranha 2, The Spawning, by these whack job producers from Europe and who took me to lunch at Zucky's, which was a restaurant in Santa Monica. I think they probably dropped a good $10 on that lunch and signed me up, you know. And it turned out it was a scam because there was this kind of crazy Italian producer, and he had an output deal with Warner Brothers that was a negative pickup, which means he'd fund the movie and then they'd pay him for the negative cost, right? But he had this deal. It was a revolving deal, and he'd already made a couple films for them. And this was the third time he was going to run the same scam because his contract said he had to have an American director. He was Italian and they didn't want that sensibility. They wanted somebody that, you know, was English as a first language sort of thing because they were going to put it out in the US. And so what the guy would do is he'd hire an American director and then fire him after a couple of days and take over. And he'd save all the scenes with the topless women for the latter part of the shoot. you can't make this shit up.
Wow.
Right? So he hired me, and I was going to be like the third fall guy in the series because I'd already done this twice. And, you know, sure enough, I'm 3 days into the shoot, and I get tapped on the shoulder, you know, kid, you're out. And he takes over. Maybe it was more like 4 days or something like that. And he had all these bullshit reasons like, oh, you know, you're spending too much time doing setups and, you know, all that sort of thing. And your stuff won't cut. But he wouldn't show me any of the footage. Hmm. And so, you know, I got the boot. And then he took over. But then Warner Brothers busted him. They said, yeah, we're getting hip to your tricks here. You're violating your contract. And they wouldn't take the picture.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, the joke was sort of on him eventually. But unfortunately, I got saddled with this first credit that was kind of bullshit. So then I realized, you know, this is sink or swim time. I better come up with something good. And that's when I wrote The Terminator. I was actually in Rome on that film when I came up with the idea for The Terminator. And it was another one of these dream things, right? Mm-hmm. Where I got this image in my head in a dream of this chrome skeleton. And I don't know, like, how it is for you guys when you dream, but for me, it's not just an image. There's almost like a kind of a narrative, you know, metadata that kind of runs with the image that says this thing used to have skin on it, but the fire burned the skin off and therefore it now looks like a skeleton, right? So it wasn't just an image. It was story or a story element, right? So I woke up, started sketching that, wrote it down. And then that became the nucleus of the whole story. And then it was like, okay, how did he get here? Is he from space? Is, you know, in the future, pretty obvious, right? Because we don't have that kind of technology now. Mm-hmm. And I had to make a film. If you think about it, it's all dead simple. I didn't have the money to do a futuristic movie. I had to shoot it on the streets of Los Angeles on a shoestring, right? So now it's futuristic technology we don't have now, but I got to shoot it now and contemporary setting. Oh, must be time travel. Okay, time travel. So what? We don't want to see it. How about just a bright flash and he shows up, right? No, seriously, it's kind of that reductive,
yeah.
Right? So anyway, and then that turned into The Terminator and we spent $4 million on that below the line, which was probably about our catering budget on The Way of Water, right? And, you know, Arnold got the rest, pretty much.
I love that I'm talking to someone who can end stories with, and anyway, that turns into The Terminator, which, yeah, right. which is amazing. But you know, going back to the directing actors thing and how you started off, I mean, I talked to Guillermo del Toro once who said that he felt it was incredibly important to take acting classes and take acting lessons to see what the actors are feeling, what they're going through.
Yeah.
Did you ever do that?
I think that would be wise, but I never did it.
Okay.
But there is a lot of acting and directing, you know, because when somebody gives you an idea, you go, yeah, that's really interesting, you know, and you gotta sell it. You gotta stick the landing on that one. You know, you can't ever be insincere.
Let me think about that one for a second.
Yeah, right. No, but look, I think I found out that speaking, you know, always sort of from a writer's standpoint, knowing what the characters are thinking and feeling in any given moment. I just found out, you know, pretty quickly that I could talk to actors, that what I said made sense to them. It took me a while to evolve that to the point where I limited what I said to them just to that which was actable in the moment, you know, as opposed to too much backstory. And too much of, hey, what you're doing now is setting the seed for what's going to happen later in the movie. That's not actable. They need to know what to do right now. Well, what am I doing in this scene? What's the truth of this scene? Mm. It took me a while to kind of figure out to say less, you know. But a big lesson for me on The Terminator, you know, was that, you know, I had a couple of actors that I really respected just from the work that I'd seen them do. And I thought, oh, well, they'll know what to do. They're really, really good actors. It's like, no, they didn't necessarily know what to do. It's very hard sometimes for actors to be objective about what they're doing. And they want to hear from the outside, you know. It's not insecurity. It's just when they're immersed, they're putting something out. They want to hear that it's the right thing, that it fits the movie. that there's somebody somewhere that's going to put all the pieces together, you know, and that what they're doing is right. Now, there are a lot of actors that sort of take control of that eventually, maybe even become directors themselves, and they don't need that kind of input. But it was kind of a shock to me that like really, really accomplished actors needed a director in the moment, in real time. You know, so you got to find, your level with every actor. And they and you'll have a bunch of different actors, and they'll need something different from you. Maybe some of them like you to just jump in while the camera's running, or do a quick reset and just pop the line again. Or hey, just give me that line again, you know. Or they'll know that the line didn't hit quite the way it should. It's just and I'll just interject while the camera's rolling and just give me that again. Just do you know. Other actors want you to stay the hell out of the way, let them do their thing, you know. And that's cool too, you know, and then regroup and talk about it after the take. Some actors like to be at the monitor and see what they did. Others don't want to know. They don't want to know. It's like, you happy boss? I'm happy. All right, let's go. You know, seriously. So it's a different relationship with every actor, and you gotta kind of find that. And that's where experience comes in.
What about someone like Arnold, who you've obviously worked with a number of times? And
well, I was terrified of Arnold. You know, when he showed up and I found out that, you know, I said, are you okay doing another take on this? And he said, it's just reps. That's what he said. He said, you get better, you do more reps, you get better. Yeah. You know, he and I actually hit it off pretty early after the first, like, you know, day of terror. You know,
was he scared of you? Or if he just did that
I doubt it. I don't think Arnold's really afraid of anybody. And I don't mean like just because he's physically big. I just think he's just got, you know, ridiculous amounts of confidence.
And it's just a way as well that, you know, looking at the work you've done with Arnold, and obviously you work with a lot of actors a lot over the years, you know, going on The Terminator alone, you know, Linda Hamilton, Mike Bean, Lance Michael. Henderson, Bill Paxton, you know, work with him again and again. But the way Arnold evolved from T1 to T2 and then in True Lies, where he's doing something completely different as well.
Well, that's a whole thing. I mean, you know, Arnold and I hit it off. He trusted me. You know, he just believed in the projects is really what it was. He actually didn't believe in T2 initially. So I wrote the script. We got on a plane to Cannes together to go sell T2 at the Cannes Festival when we were both, you know, we were working for Carolco at that time. And I gave him the script. He read it on the plane. We got together for a breakfast meeting in Cannes. And he had this really troubled look on his face. And I said, what? He goes, Jim, I don't kill anybody. I was like, I know, it's great. They'll never see that coming. Isn't that cool? It's like, but Jim, I'm the Terminator. I'm the guy that kicks the door in and just machine guns everybody. It's what I do. It's like, I know, but this is like different. They won't see it coming. It's a big surprise. I don't know. He said, you know, I spent like an hour talking him into it, right?
Yeah.
And then we're paying the check. I'm about to get up. And he goes, oh, wait. Before John Connor shows up and tells me I can't kill anybody, I can kill people then. I'm like, oh, you got me there, you know? Except no.
Yeah.
Because if you're the hero, you're the hero.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? And... okay. And I think that's actually the moment where I really earned his trust, because he didn't believe in what I had written, but he did it anyway. Mm. And it worked out. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
When he saw how it was working, you know, it's not like he had to go to the premiere to see that it was working. You know, he saw it as we went along. It started to click for him, you know, that this is really cool. And it was cool to see him in that heroic role, but with all that sort of innate badassery that he had from the first movie, it actually worked out pretty well.
And both the Terminator films, and in fact, a lot of your movies, you know, are about the dangers of technology. And this is something that's been very much on your mind. I mean, it's obviously writ large in both Avatars.
It's a dualism, right? Because it's, you know, it's a love-hate relationship with technology. And I think, you know, a lot, if not most of the ills of humanity and what we inflict on each other and on the world come from our mastery of technology. Everything gets weaponized eventually. And yet, everything that we've achieved and a lot of what's great about us, our deeper understanding of the natural world through science and things like that, is all part of all as a result of technology. So I'm pretty ambivalent about technology. And I think that it's a strong ambivalence, if you know what I mean. I show both, you know. Well, you know, Sigourney kicks the alien queen's ass with a power loader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if that wasn't there, she wouldn't stand much of a chance.
That's true. Very true. But this is something that's been on your mind right from the off. I mean, even from the '70s.
Yeah. And I think I'm pretty thematically consistent about that. Even Titanic, even though it's not a science fiction film, is still about our relationship with technology. You know, the Titanic was this grand machine. It was representative of a time when people thought everything was going to be progress. Everything was going to get better as a result of our mastery of steel. And our ability to control energy, you know, through steam power and things mm-hmm. like that. And then it all went pear-shaped. Mm-hmm. And that was right before World War I. And we saw what mechanized warfare did to people.
Mm-hmm.
And the 20th century was all about, you know, the technology turning on us, you know, the dragon biting back.
Was that something that informed Aliens to an extent for you as well?
Well, sure. So you've got this, you know, this highly, mechanized force, you know, with their advanced weaponry coming in and fighting something that had no technology whatsoever and beat them. So in my mind, at that time, that was a metaphor for the Vietnam War, where the Viet Cong were using sharpened bamboo sticks and you know, kind of hand-me-down, you know, Soviet Kalashnikovs against gunships, helicopters, arc light bombers, you know, B-52s and all that stuff. And they won, you know. So to me, it was a metaphor about hubris and putting too much of your faith in technology and the assumption of superiority.
Before you come in, when we were talking about you behind your back, we were talking about our favorite Jim Cameron moments. And Get Away From Her, You Bitch was very, very high on the list.
It's up there on my list.
It's a hell of a moment. And the last time I spoke to you was with Edgar Wright. I did the interview with you and Edgar for the magazine about a year and a half ago. And you were talking about that scene. And what you said fascinated me. You were talking about how you kept the audience in mind all the way through, the pacing of that shot.
Yeah.
From the moment Ripley appears in the power loader. Can you talk about how you paced that?
The door goes up. Well, let's talk about that scene for a second, because that's a classic example of what screenwriters call plant payoff. You set it up early and you forget about it. And then you pay it off when you need it, right? So it's classic plant payoff. And you don't see it coming. You sort of do, because I do these inserts where she's doing something and maybe that triggers a memory, maybe it doesn't. Kind of had my cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
You know, because I show her putting the thing on, but it's all done in these abstract cuts. But then you've got the door going up, which is the reveal. And the reveal, you know, it's interesting because you kind of clap at the reveal, but it hasn't, you haven't really stuck the landing yet, right? And then she clomps forward right up into a close-up and then drops the line. And the audience went ape shit at the premiere. It was overwhelming, you know, far beyond my expectations. I mean, I knew the line worked, right?
Yeah.
But to see, you know, so it's a premiere in Westwood in Hollywood, and this is in 1986, July of 86. And Hollywood comes out to either hate you or celebrate you. Now, they come out to assassinate you, but if you can win them, they will celebrate, because it's cinema, right? They'll celebrate it. And they went apeshit. And these are like studio people and agents and, you know, that sort of thing. And that was a very fulfilling moment. I didn't have anything like that on Terminator, because we didn't have a premiere and they were too cheap. Seriously, they were too cheap to have a premiere. You know, I'd sneak into a theater and I'd see people kind of laughing or cheering or whatever.
Yeah,
but this was different, you know. And, it's great when you propose an idea and it actually works. And Sigourney just sold it like crazy. And Sigourney was there, right? And she, the funny thing is, you know, everything's a bit of a revision with everybody always. But Sigourney didn't really like the movie at first because there was too much, you know, gunfire and stuff like that. And mm-hmm. she was basically, you know, anti-gun, you know, very kind of liberal stance. And I agree with her 100%, but it was Aliens. She read the script. You're going to hose the eggs with a flamethrower and a machine gun. Sorry. I'm not changing that, you know? So she was kind of like, you know, and then that moment happened and she was like, they like me. They like me in this character. And she didn't even know if that was a good thing at that point, but she came around.
That's amazing. So in your mind, when you were editing that moment and shooting that moment and pacing that moment, were you thinking about audience reaction? Like the minute she appears, the audience getting excited, leaving a gap for the line? Was that something you were thinking about?
I think when you're directing a movie, you're sort of making it for yourself, but you got to carry an audience around in your mind. Mm-hmm. You know, there are various theories, theory of mind, kind of mirror neuron concept where you kind of run a simulation of what the other person you're with thinks if you know them, right? If you know a person well, you have a little simulation you can run of what they're going to think about what you're about to say. And you can know if it's something that they'll like or something that will push their buttons and piss them off or whatever it is. And we do that. We do that with each other and we do it even with strangers based on an expectation of what that person might think. And we do it all the time, right? But a director has to do it for not a person, but hundreds of people in a kind of generic audience simulation, right? And it's not as simple as just making it work for you. You have to be savvy enough to know what more people in an audience might think. And I think it's one of the hardest things about making a movie, and part and parcel of that is now you've watched your movie in pieces and you're putting it together and you see the film over and over and over again, but you still have to see it for the first time. And a movie like this, 5 years of production, and over 5 years, I've seen every shot at fractal microscopic detail and every shot, you know, more or less completed thousands of times, and the whole cut of scenes, you know, hundreds of times. And how do you stay objective? How do you still have that fresh audience in your mind that's seeing it for the first time? It's a hard thing to do. It's a discipline and ultimately becomes impossible. Ultimately, it becomes impossible to really know what people are going to think until you put it in front of them and get a reaction, which literally just happened over the last couple of days.
So have you been able to test The Way of Water at all? Did you test Avatar?
We did some early tests, and we learned a lot from that about what was working and what wasn't working. And then you use that to modify your cut and you emphasize certain things, and maybe even a couple of problems emerge that you have to do something about, which we had. That's part of the process as well. But you really don't know how an audience is going to react to the finished film until you go to a screening. So you were at one of the first screenings. I think you were probably at the third screening where we actually showed it to people.
Yeah.
And, you know, the response seems to be pretty good so far. So hopefully, fingers crossed.
But going into The Way of Water, you know, having directed two of the greatest sequels of all time, what lessons did you bring into that from Aliens and T2?
Well, they're general, because you're never going to solve this, you know, a different problem the same way you've solved another problem in the past. But the idea of a sequel in general, you want to be true to what the audience loves and expects. But on the other hand, you want to smack them upside the head and say, we're doing this instead. And what this is better be at least as good as what they expected. Surprise is great unless it's a negative surprise, right? So it has to be positive surprise. And so, you know, it's a question of how much can you turn it around? You know, I mean, making Arnold the good guy, we play around with this expectation that he's there to assassinate John as well. Maybe the other guy's there to help him. And then it turns out to be the other way around. Now, we kind of gave that away in the marketing materials, in the trailer and stuff. We kind of gave away that he was going to be the good guy. So, but I think people can even go along with ideas where they're not supposed to know, but they already do, but you kind of play the game with a movie. you know, sometimes. So I think they were willing to sort of play that game, even though they'd seen the trailer where Arnold's the good guy. You know, it's kind of a weird kind of duality of like, well, okay, I know what they're doing, but I can admire the way they do it.
Yeah.
Where I'm not supposed to know, but I do anyway, you know.
If you had your time again, would you hide the fact that Arnold was the good guy in the marketing?
I believe in that marketing campaign, because rule one is you got to get people to show up, and you got to do something that's on its face intriguing enough to get them to want to come to see it. So I don't think much was lost with that being a reveal at the end of Act One. It's not like it was The Sixth Sense and we blew the big reveal, you know, in the trailer.
And with this movie, did you have marketing in mind as you're developing it? Is there a moment where you know?
I think less so.
Okay.
I think I was dealing more kind of organically with the story of Jake and Neytiri going forward and becoming parents. And I think I knew that this film was going to be surprising to people. Like, you guys haven't seen the film yet, right? So you're going off trailer materials and some images and the lobby and all that. And, you know, it looks cool and all that. And it kind of looks like a brochure for Bora Bora, right? It is so not that. But I can't really, you know, I can't really describe where it goes, because it's all about getting in the heads of the characters and then going through their journey with them and feeling the fear and the loss and the grief and all the bad shit that happens in this movie and coming out the other side of that in a kind of epiphanal state. I mean, I'm describing the movie that you saw, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And in fairness, I signed the most terrifying NDA I have ever signed. So all I'm saying is I'll agree with this gentleman entirely.
I think it was a little bit more of an organic process. I wasn't thinking backwards from a marketing hook. So now we're in post-production and we're like, okay, well, what's the hook? You know, we're talking to Disney, we're talking to their, you know, marketing people. It's like, family. Okay, great. So then a whole bunch of trailers came in that were about family, about Jake and Neytiri. I said, wait a minute. Jake and Neytiri aged people don't go to the movies anymore. We need 18-year-olds. 18-year-old doesn't want to hear about family from the parents' point of view. Trust me on this. Right? So then we thought, oh, well, we got to tell the kids' story too. You know, and it turned out that there was actually a balance to be found there. People wanted to feel like the story continued with Jake and Neytiri, but they also wanted to see new things.
Yeah.
And I think the trailer does promise that. The series of trailers promise that.
Without giving too much away in case someone shoots me with a gun, but there are...
Shoot you with a lawyer.
Shoot you with a lawyer. There are things, I'm choosing my words very carefully here, Jim, but there are scenes and sequences in this, the complexity of it, is astonishing. It blew my mind. I mean, was this a bigger movie, a bigger production than the first Avatar for you?
There's an interesting thing going on here. Okay, so the film is longer.
Uh-huh.
People wanted the first film to be longer. It's like, be careful what you ask for. That I can do, right? It's longer because there are more characters to service and there's more complexity in the story, which I think is actually a good thing, personally, for this film. You know, I think that what we set out to do was drop you back into Pandora very quickly, get you into Jake and Neytiri's lives, let Jake take you through the 15 years that's in between the first film and the second one, take you through having kids, being a father, you know, their life. Then the humans come back and it all goes to hell. And then we cut to a year later and they're at war again. And then ultimately it becomes a kind of a refugee story where they're displaced from the forest and they have to go to the ocean. But I think where the surprises really start is when we start to follow the kids. And we just kind of go off of Jake and Neytiri for a while and we follow the kids. And then all of a sudden that story is as compelling as Jake and Neytiri's story. And that was by design. It's not really about handing off the baton so much as introducing new characters and new complexity into it, right? Because Jake and Neytiri are through the whole saga as it's all written out. Four is written, five is written. These are shootable scripts. They may be tinkered with a bit, but I consider them shooting scripts. And they're right through the whole saga right to the end. But, you know, we wanted to play the epic game. And in epics, there are more characters and there are more threads to follow. But here's the interesting thing. The first movie follows a classic, if you guys know, the kind of the Joseph Campbell archetypes of mythic storytelling. It follows that actually fairly clearly. Second movie doesn't at all. Doesn't at all. It's kind of an intimate epic. You know, in the first movie, you've got giant armies being raised and massive clash of forces, good versus evil at the end and all that kind of stuff. And Jake emerges as the mytho heroic character on the orange, you know, creature and all that. That's not what happens in the second movie. Second movie, quite frankly, it's like a slow Tuesday afternoon and a bunch of shit goes down. Right? You know, he doesn't go out and raise any army, but it still feels epic, right? But it's a more intimate epic, more closely focused on the characters and the bonds between the family members and all that. I don't think I'm spoiling anything there. You're going to have to see how that plays out. And by the way, Titanic sinks, you know that going in. doesn't ruin your appreciation of the film. So it kind of plays by different rules, and I think that's okay, but it's scary, right? So you're doing a movie at the highest budget level there is, and there's so much pressure just from kind of industry standards, not from the studio. They were cool, but just the self-induced pressure to play by the rules of a classic happy ending and the good guy kills the bad guy and all that sort of thing, and none of that happens. So that's pretty scary, you know. On the other hand, it's kind of exciting. Artistically, it's exciting. I don't want to just tell the same story again. Plus, we're teeing up a lot of stuff that gets paid off in later films. So I don't want to give the impression, by the way, that it's just kind of this bleeding, open-ended thing where you just kind of drive off a cliff. Because as much as I love The Lord of the Rings, that first film just fucking ends. Like, what the fuck? I got to wait until next year to see what happens next. You know, I mean, I love the films. I really do. Don't get me wrong. But holy shit. Talk about a gamble.
There are two amazing quotes from you I want to discuss very, very briefly and how they pertain to The Way of Water. One, I've already said to you guys tonight, is in 2014, you said to this very magazine, about this movie, you'll shit yourself with your mouth wide open.
Well, you see it. I don't know.
Was that something you kept in mind as you were developing the Web?
That was pretty much our goal, you know. Just wrote that on the whiteboard every morning. Okay, guys, this is what we got to do. No, I think it's surprisingly easy to get people around you who are designers and visual effects people that want to be on a team whose goal is to just have people gobsmacked, right? To just put on a big, high-quality show. And it's not as simple as just creating cool designs and doing cool effects. It's got to work in kind of perfect synchronization with the character stuff. So there are little tiny scenes in this movie where people just talk for like two pages, you know?
Yeah.
And then there's the big, fast-paced kind of epic stuff. It's all about, in my mind, it's about creating dynamic range and modulating it kind of symphonically toward a culmination.
There's another quote from you, which I wonder if you still adhere to a little bit, but I'm probably misquoting, but you once said, more, less isn't more, more is more.
More is more.
More is more. Is that something you still cling to?
Hell yeah. But that said, I think we've all seen movies over the last 10 years where more was too much, you know, where it's like, how many buildings do I need to see collapse with the good guy and the bad guy fighting through the buildings? And by the way, how many hundreds of thousands of people are lying dead in the wake of that little fight, you know? And it just goes on and on and on, you know, and until you're numb. So one of the things I was really concerned about in this film, because a lot happens in the last act, is that it wasn't too exhausting to the point that people unplug. And I feel like we hit a pretty good balance where there's some pretty kinetic, adrenalized stuff, and then it stops. And then it turns into like a more emotional scene. It's equally powerful, but it's just different and it's quieter. And then it cranks up again and then it gets quieter again. And so there's this kind of strange kind of dynamic. So we tried to keep it always riveting, but it's not just once the action starts, 30, 40 minutes of just the loudest shit you ever heard, because I think there's a little more to it than that. But we always made sure that there was something compelling all the time. And, you'll judge for yourselves when you see it. And maybe it's overkill for some people and maybe it's underkill for other people. But the key thing is to be emotionally invested at all times. I think that's absolutely critical. And there's never an action scene where a main character isn't at the center of it all the time, 100% of the time. We don't just cut to massive armies fighting just because it's cool.
I've seen the movie described, and not by you, but as perhaps your most personal film. You're a father of five. You've got a family yourself.
Yeah, I think it's valid.
Yeah.
I mean, on reflection, I don't think I thought about that at the time, but I was bringing to bear everything that I knew, that I had experienced that was important to me. So my love of the ocean, the amount of time I've spent underwater, the awe and wonder that I have for the natural world, my love of indigenous culture, my fascination with that, and my feeling that the family is the most important thing. I talk about it. This family is our fortress, and it's not always fun. It's sometimes irksome and problematic, and we see that too. And and I wanted to deal with it, like I said earlier, from the perspective of these teenage characters. Because I had been, we've all been teens, right? So we know that that's like maybe in some ways the hardest time in your life, because you don't know where you're going, you don't know where you fit in, And your parents don't understand you, of course, because all parents don't understand their teens. But I've been on the other side of it as well as a father, and my kids are mostly grown now, although I have one that's about to turn 16. But they're sort of either late teens or into their 20s and 30s, actually. And I've seen how you do it wrong as a parent. I've seen how you do it right. You learn as you go along. And, Jake's still on that curve. He isn't quite there yet, as we see in the film. He's a pretty authoritarian dad because of his military background and because the survival stakes that they're in the middle of a war and as refugees. I'm just writing the things that I've lived and that fascinate me. And so in a way it is pretty personal. But I think that's good. I think that's a strength as an artist to get your own stuff up there, because you speak from authority and you have conviction. Because you got to have conviction as a filmmaker. It's got to be instinctive. You can't sit and equivocate about every artistic decision. You make 10,000 decisions a day, little ones, sometimes big ones, as you go along.
And prior to this, what would you say would be your most personal film? Would The Abyss qualify?
Yeah, maybe The Abyss. Yeah, that's a good possibility. Sure. I mean, there's personal stuff in every film.
Yeah.
When I wrote Ripley and the little girl in that, is a bit abstract for me. I wasn't a parent at that time. Mm-hmm. I can kind of project it. And kind of imagine
pretty
what
darn
it would
well,
feel
Jim,
like. Yeah, look, I mean, I think any good writer can project themselves into other situations and make it real for themselves. As a male writer, I can project myself into the female reality of a character, like Lindsay in The Abyss or Sarah or whatever. You have to be able to do that. But I think you might have a slight advantage, or at least it's more satisfying when it's something that you actually lived. And I can hear echoes of things I've said. I can hear echoes of things my kids have said in the dialogue when I watch the movie. And they think it's hysterical. It's like, Dad, you think you're doing me, but that is so not me.
Yeah,
which is fine too.
Yeah.
You know.
But finding the personal in something like Titanic, where the stakes are so high. And so
well,
huge.
Jack is a young starving artist, right? So, you know, I was a young starving artist. You know, I never met anybody like Kate, but you know, that's the fantasy part. But I always wanted to impress a girl with my portfolio. You know, look at my sketches, aren't I cool? You know,
and so there's a line that tracks through from the abyss, and you know, well, let's leave Piranha 2 aside for the time being.
Thank
but
you.
The abyss. All the way through to Titanic, all the way through to this movie, of water.
Yeah.
Is that something that's driven you all your life? You've been fascinated with all your life?
Well, look, I'm fascinated by diving. I love being underwater. There's some kind of strange connection there. I think that for those of you that aren't divers or especially free divers, there's something that happens when you get into that Zen state on a free dive where your heart rate has slowed down. That's a natural reaction of the human body to being under pressure. And you have the mammalian diving reflex, which causes everything to kind of slow down. To do it successfully, you have to get into a very Zen mindset. You can't be agitated or your heart will speed up and you'll use oxygen faster. You have to force yourself to be extremely calm and to process very clearly, you know, in that state. So it's kind of meditative. It's quiet. You don't have a lot of scuba bubbles, you know, boiling past your ear. So you kind of hear the faint sounds of the creatures in the reef, and you kind of feel a connection, and you sense the movement of the water. You know, it's all very, very, you know, primeval. It may even be a triggering of sense memories that go back much further than just your own lifespan. Maybe it's going back to the womb. Maybe it's the 9 months we spend suspended in weightlessness in fluid, right? And it's an atavistic memory. Maybe it's more atavistic than that. Maybe it's going back millions of years to prior states of being that are, you know, deeply encoded in our genome and our epigenetics, right? Mm-hmm. I can't account for it. I love it. You know, I enjoy it. I'm compelled artistically to deal with it, you know, to share it. Even the documentary films, I'm bringing back experiences from underwater to share in a documentary format. So it goes way beyond, you know, you're just talking about the features, but I've done probably 6 or 7 ocean-oriented documentary films, more on the way, including most recently the Secrets of the Whales, you know, which, you know, was an Emmy winner last year. Mm-hmm. So that'll be ongoing for me. But once again, it's just combining the things that I love into one story.
So you took 8 years off after Titanic to do a lot of diving.
To do deep exploration, yeah.
You're not going to get that chance this time around, I'm guessing, straight into...
You know, I think I'm running out of 8-year tranches of stuff I can go do if I want to get these Avatar movies done.
Yeah. So how deep are you in the weeds on Avatar 3 at the moment?
Right now, nothing. I'm just enjoying a little break before I have to go back and finish my prison sentence. But no, it's shot. It's captured. I'm done with the actors, basically. So next we go into a phase that's basically what we call camera. So it's me picking up the virtual camera, doing the lighting for all the scenes, doing all the coverage. And then we edit it and fire it all off to Weta VFX, you know, for the finish work. They're in Wellington. I live in Wellington. They're right there in Wellington. So we know exactly how to do it. It's a very creative process, but it's not the most creative process. The most creative process is with the actors.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. But Jim, it's been an absolute pleasure. And please.
Well, thanks. Thanks. I really enjoy this. You know, I love talking about the work. I don't get a chance to do it that much because we're busy doing the work. So so thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me here to do this. I really enjoyed it.
Fantastic. Please give it up. James Cameron, everybody.